This edition of Section D was first broadcast on the 16th of July 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Aled John. Coming up today, we head to Israel, where fashion writers and ultra-Orthodox Jews are striking up a somewhat uneasy relationship.
Started with exchanging knowledge about what's going on in men's fashion, from the importance of the army and the fact that you're 3 years, every man here is confined to uniforms.
We give our verdict on the structure at the center of New York's Museum of Modern Art's warm-up music series, this year designed by Coda.
A kind of split personality object, we called it a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but a friendly one, that could kind of suck in the seating during the dance party and then let it go depending on the different programs.
Plus, we celebrate 30 years of hard toil for Marie Wilkinson as creative director of glasses brand Cutler and Gross.
It's between craftsmanship and the technicality of producing a very high-end watch. You know, we produce the same technical drawings as watchmakers produce. So it's merging emotion with a very ergonomic product. It's a very curious mix.
And as summer gets well underway, we culminate our series on the graduation shows taking place across the capital with today's final edition from the Architectural Association. All that and more here on Section D with me, Aled John, on Monocle 24. We begin this week in the Middle East, an area oft overlooked in design coverage. The Israeli fashion industry is sluggish compared with the country's booming technology sector. Particularly in the realm of men's fashion, Israel's short history has entrenched a utilitarian approach to clothing. However, an uneasy relationship between a new generation of Tel Aviv fashion writers and the country's ultra-Orthodox religious population is starting to shake things up, as Monocle's Joseph Dana reports from Tel Aviv.
The first thing you notice about Tel Aviv is the humidity. In the summertime, the city bakes under relentless Middle Eastern sun, and most residents hit the streets wearing as few clothes as possible. But this is not the case with all Israelis. Despite scorching heat, ultra-Orthodox Israeli men can be found wearing attire best suited for Eastern Europe, not the Middle East.
In my opinion, it's beautiful. I mean, it's so far-fetched when you see them on the street that, and it's always very, very well tailored, usually, and it's always like clean and sleek, black, white.
That is Israeli fashion journalist Yara Kedar describing the fashion of the ultra-Orthodox.
I think the way they dress expresses a certain message that they are detached. It has nothing to do with the weather. And, you know, winter, summer, I mean, doesn't matter, they still wear these fur hats, these tailored coats, socks. It's like they don't take in anything from their environment.
To describe Israeli men's fashion as casual would be an understatement. The rugged socialist foundations of the country, along with the ever-present heat, have come to define the extreme functionality of men's fashion trends in Israel. It is not uncommon to attend a wedding where all the men are dressed in jeans, sandals, and t-shirts. Eyal Deleux is the co-founder of The Garçonnière, a popular Israeli men's fashion blog that is slowly changing the way Israelis approach fashion. He is also the head of external relations for Design Museum Holon. At a popular Tel Aviv cafe, where the waitstaff seemed to be competing for the title of most ironically dressed, I asked him to describe the inspiration behind the blog and why men's fashion is so neglected in Israel.
Well, first of all, it started with exchanging knowledge about what's going on in men's fashion. And that was internally between us, and then complaining about what's going on with Israeli guys and the way they dress, the way they treat fashion and treat themselves. And we decided, instead of complaining to each other, just to share the knowledge and the things that we see in the world in a blog platform. And that was the beginning. You know, from the importance of the army and the fact that you're 3 years, every man here is confined to uniforms. And of course the history of the state and the anti-bourgeoisie movements that brought the socialist country and denied any clothing or any attire which is more than practical to explore the land and conquer it.
While it is common to find secular Israeli men cutting out the necklines of t-shirts to make them more comfortable, the ultra-Orthodox community maintains an attention to detail with clothing that borders on the obsessive. From a varied scattering of villages and towns across Eastern Europe, the ultra-Orthodox in Israel, like in New York or London, use dress as a means of separating themselves from secular society. As a result of this desire to be separated, clothing takes on an almost religious meaning. For those in the secular design scene, like Delor, it is a refreshing break from the informality of Tel Aviv's fashion circles.
It's still amazing to see, because they do have attire, they do have strict rules, and it's fascinating to observe them. Again, perhaps you can call it anthropological look. I mean, perhaps that's the way they look at us. It's a society with very strict rules, and every different fold of the sock or different coat, different hat, immediately puts you in a different community inside Orthodoxy. So if we're talking about clothes as a mean of identity or communication, they definitely do it to the extreme.
So it seems that an almost impossible kinship is developing between secular fashion designers and writers in Tel Aviv and the ultra-Orthodox. Well, maybe kinship is too strong a word to describe this delicate relationship. Delor noted that many Tel Avivians feel like they need a visa to enter Jerusalem, a city which has become notably conservative due to the influence of the ultra-Orthodox. To be sure, there is a growing desire among many in Tel Aviv to siphon off some of the pride that exists inside the ultra-Orthodox community for their clothing styles. One problem facing contemporary Israeli designers in general, and men's designers specifically, is pride in the creative inspiration Israel can offer. According to Sahar Shalev, he is the co-founder of the Gossonier and a fashion writer for the Israeli daily Haaretz.
We are talking today after I saw like three schools of fashion's final collections. Most of them are looking for inspirations everywhere in the world, like everywhere, but Israel. I think that like among like maybe 60 students that I saw in the past like 2 weeks, maybe 10 are actually looking at their families, or their tradition, or their heritage in or Israel, and look there for inspiration. So looking like locally for inspiration, I think is something that we still need to work on.
Outside of the carefully guarded walls of Tel Aviv's fashion world, the relationship between secular and religious Israelis is tense. In profound ways, the country's secular dress code, which sought to highlight the rugged identity of the new Hebrew Jew, capable of reclaiming the biblical homeland, was created in direct opposition to the style of bespectacled bookish Jews of Eastern Europe. The developing interest among Tel Aviv's fashion designers in the once frowned upon styles of the ultra-Orthodox is, at its most fundamental, a sign that Israel is maturing as a society, however slowly. For Monocle, in Tel Aviv, I'm Joseph Damon.
Lots more coming up, including the outdoor music series Gracing New York, put on by the Museum of Modern Art. And we celebrate the 30 years of labor at Cutler & Gross by the designer Marie Wilkinson.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back, and for those of you just joining us, you're listening to Section D with me, Alad John, here on Monocle 24. The New York Museum of Modern Art, PS1's annual outdoor music series and dance party's name, Warm Up, is an understatement. With an excellent lineup full of surprises and the perfect summer atmosphere, it's no surprise that every week the line to enter the museum in Queens serpents around the block. But one guest is always sure to stand out, the structure in the courtyard. Every year, local architects compete for the chance to exhibit in this unique space. This year, the architecture firm Coda built the party wall, as Pauline Eiferman reports.
It's 4 p.m. on a hot Saturday afternoon, and a sea of people swarms around the party wall. It's a tall, mysterious structure resembling a large wooden animal, a Trojan horse, with a porous facade that creates playful shadows on MoMA PS1's angular courtyard. Caroline O'Donnell is the 38-year-old architect behind it. Originally from Northern Ireland, she set up her firm Coda in upstate New York after studying and working in the United States. As she gives me a tour of the structure, it's clear to see why this intricate and multifaceted project seduced the judges.
We should go around the back. The reason it's called Party Wall is that, well, obviously there's a party here every Saturday, a big dance party, but it's kind of a play on words because a party wall is a shared wall in architecture, and so it's about this idea of sharing a wall between different user groups. Normally the brief that MoMA PS1 gives out is water, shade, and seating for the dance party, but this year they added another component, which is quite a big deal. It was not just to think about the party on Saturdays, but to think about all of the other uses it could have during the week, so lectures, movie screenings, dance performances, things like that. And all of those were in contradiction with the brief of the dance party. The dance party needs as much free floor area as possible. You have thousands of visitors. And the lectures and the other activities, of course, involve seating, which takes up a lot of space. We called it a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but a friendly one. That could kind of suck in the seating during the dance party and then let it go depending on the different programs.
Party Wall is this year's winner of the Young Architects Program, a competition created 14 years ago by New York's Museum of Modern Art. Designed to foster architectural innovation and create a platform for young talent, the program also serves to activate the courtyard during the summer, says Pedro Gadano, curator for contemporary architecture at the museum and one of the jurors.
We have a long process of selection. And finally, there are five finalists that will respond to a brief, which is very simple. Something that will provide shade in the very hot summer afternoons of New York, but also to present a sort of reflection on ecological aspects. Like in this case this year, in the proposal of Coda, about recycling, about entering the cycle of production of materials, taking advantage of local resources that she found, collaborating with companies, and bringing those materials into this sort of low-budget construction.
Those materials, in the case of the party wall, are skateboard byproducts. She and her team approached Comet, a manufacturer of eco-friendly skateboards that had mountains of leftover scraps they use for firewood during the winter. By weaving together the hollow rectangular planks, the team created an ornate lace facade that covers the massive structure, which they determined should be 37 feet high after studying the movement of the sun.
We knew that we couldn't do another canopy, and as soon as we kind of took the idea of a canopy and flipped it on its side, we realized that as long as you understand the movement of the sun and understand how that's related to the height of the wall, then you can create the same amount of shadow but with a vertical device rather than a horizontal. And we were pretty excited at that moment because we realized when we had this vertical surface, which was kind of like a sign or a wall, that we started to be one of the kind of family members of this whole collection of signs and billboards that are in the neighborhood here. So if you look at this project from the roof and you see, or from the train even, or the highway on the approach, you see all of these kind of little animals on the horizon kind of grazing that are the billboards, and you realize that this is just one of the herd.
But this animal lives in a very peculiar environment. Pedro Gadano explains the space can be an intimidating one, not only because of the museum's prestige, but also because of its physical shape.
The patio is quite complex in plan. It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. So it could be a very strange location to work with. But I think that's a stimulus for the architects. So they actually respond in very different ways. I mean, if Caroline this year responded with this idea of the party wall, a dividing wall or a shared wall that divides the space and creates different areas, last year's proposal by HWKN was actually a sort of massive star-shaped structure that touched in three of the smaller courtyards. So it was positioned in a way that it could activate the three different patios with different functions. So I think architects have been very responsive to that spatial complexity of the patio, and they always offer new ways of using that space.
One of the most interesting aspects of the structure is the bottom, where around 130 benches made out of misprinted skateboards can be detached. Some are equipped with soft trucks instead of legs, which allows visitors to practice their tricks or to build inventive deck chairs. That ticked off the seating requirement, leaving for last the water component.
We knew already that we have a wall, and so wall plus water very simply equals kind of aqueduct. So we have this channel that runs along the top that ducts water along it and then projects it out the end to the last pool. And then there are a series of pools kind of in the feet of this of the wall. They kind of make spaces inside the feet. They're kind of room-like versus this thing that's kind of monstrous from the outside and very imposing. I think to be on the inside is kind of amazingly different. It's much more intimate and delicate in here, so I like that. All of that kind of mental work that has to happen might be frustrating to some people, and they might never get to that point, but I think it's important that it's possible that, some people even just start the process of thinking about it, and maybe a few people get all the way to kind of full revelation.
One revelation that is sure to take place is the one of Coda's immense talent to the world. Many previous Young Architects Program winners have gone on to gain international recognition. And thanks to a growing interest in global partners, the Young Architects Program is sure to keep its promise of forging architectural innovation and of using design to create unrivaled party experiences year after year. For Monocle in New York, I'm Polly Neiferman.
This is Section D with me, Alad John. This month, London-based eyewear brand Cutler & Gross celebrate creative director Marie Wilkinson's 30th anniversary with the company. We sent our Alexandra de Kramer to meet the lady herself to find out what she has picked up along the way, how eyewear defines the features of an individual's face, and what makes Cutler & Gross so different as a brand.
It began with me being a slightly reluctant dispensing optician, graduating and not quite knowing what I was going to do. And a friend introduced me to Cutler & Gross because he'd been for an interview there and came back and told me that it was a very, very interesting place. They had an old-fashioned workshop upstairs where they were actually making frames one by one. And he said, it'd be great for you, you go. So I went to meet Mr. Gross. And we were very happy to meet each other because he didn't want a traditional optician and I didn't want a traditional opticians. So it was a very happy meeting.
And how has it grown from the first day you started until now?
It's grown immensely. There were four people when I arrived. There was Mr. Cutler, Mr. Gross, a frame maker and a receptionist, Kay Beck. So yeah, I swelled the numbers and it's been growing ever since. You know, when you talk to other people about the brand, it's the passion. People, everyone feels like they own Cutler & Gross, that the pair of glasses that they have for them is unique, and it pretty much is. It's unique to them, and people like to personalise it, and I think that's... So people are very, very passionate and very loyal about the brand. What we do, I think, is pretty unique. The fact that we hand make in our own factory, that we do everything is done ourselves, so from the design to the prototyping to the production, our PR, everything is done in-house. We control every aspect. And we're opening more and more stores now. We've just opened in New York on Mercer Street, which is great. And we're going to be having two more openings this year, which I can't really say about yet. But yes, there's two more openings on the cards. So it's growing in a really wonderful way. It's an interesting process because it's between craftsmanship and the technicality of producing a very high-end watch. You know, we produce the same technical drawings as watchmakers produce. The beginning of the concept stage, it's a very emotional process, actually. So it's, you know, merging emotion with a very ergonomic product. It's a very curious mix.
What has inspired you throughout your career?
Initially, Mr. Cutler and Mr. Gross, through their passion of wanting, being so single-minded about wanting to produce very beautiful individual glasses, and both having, you know, putting the emotion and the technicality into glasses too, right from an early time, through to seeing how people wear glasses. And I'm always interested in how people worn glasses throughout the time, and also in real life. I mean, I'm an optician too, so talking to people about the psychology of wearing glasses is very interesting too. Change your face, changes your emotions, it changes the way you feel about yourself, people's perception to you. So it's all linked in with that way. So choosing glasses for people is not an easy thing. I think to do it well, you really have to spend time with someone to get to know them and to feel about their reaction to glasses, whether it's a positive thing, maybe it's not so positive, but it's very important to know the reasoning behind glasses wearing. It's not just about a prescription. There's more to it.
What are some tips that you give to the customers that come in terms of how they should pick their glasses or their connection to their eyewear?
The best thing, actually, I think, is to try on lots of glasses, if it's your first time particularly, just to get used to wearing them and just sort of study your reaction to them, whether it's a positive, warm reaction, whether they make you smile, or whether, you know, they're giving you a feeling and an expression that you shouldn't have. And to listen to other people too, you know, if you're going to an optician's, take advice.
What are some anecdotes that stick in your head from the past years that you would say define your career or definitive moments of your career?
I think my initial anecdote was my first week. We had Arva Gardner and Grace Jones come into the shop. So that defined how I thought about Cutler and Grace. I thought this was a very special place. And since then, defining moments. I mean, one exciting moment, I think, was actually when we acquired the factory in Italy, because we became so free. You know, we've always worked with small artisanal factories, but it's always, you know, it's been not always maybe on their terms and not so much on our terms. You know, it's been a beautiful learning process, but actually having our own factory and being responsible and it's been, yeah, very liberating and really, really exciting. So that's been a pretty special moment, I think.
What about the creative process?
I mean, we're sort of an ideas factory here. We have an atelier in Neasden where all the design occurs. So that's kind of a beautiful house of ideas. We have a creative director, Monica Chong, and also just spending time in this shop. It's very important to go back to the heart of Cutler and Gross. So I go back to number 16, Knightsbridge Green, okay. Spend some time there. I always look at the archive to look at the glasses, see how Mr. Cutler and Mr. Gross reacted to certain things, or you know, if they were thinking about round glasses, how were they thinking about round glasses at certain times of their life, and then how we relate it to how one would wear a round eye now. I think it's very important to put things into context.
You have some very eccentric glasses as well. I saw the monochrome one yesterday. Yes. What are some of the most outstanding glasses you've ever designed, eccentric?
The most challenging, I think, were our Mondrian glasses, because we actually made the plastic before we started cutting up the glasses. Okay. So that was very challenging, placing the colour blocks in the right place and the precision in placing them, and then landscaping and milling the surface to create the Mondrian landscape. So that was a real challenge to work out. I love doing that.
That was Marie Wilkinson of Cutler & Gross talking to our Alexandra de Kramer there. Now time for our weekly peek into the working environs of a designer or two on our radar. The husband and wife team of Nurit Koniak and David Lebanthal share a recently renovated space in the heart of Tel Aviv. Koniak, a graphic designer, and Lebanthal, an architect, have found that by sharing a studio space, they are able to complement each other's design interests. Their studio is housed in a majestic 1920s building, complete with a colourful array of floor tiles typical of Tel Aviv flats. They gave us a tour of their new digs.
We're actually in south central Tel Aviv, on the edge between the historical centre of Tel Aviv. We like the area because it's perfect for us. It's kind of on a route between our house, our children's nursery school, and this is our center of Tel Aviv. At the moment, we have a couple more workers than we had in the past, and there is a sense of family, which is nice. The boardroom actually doubles up into our lunch room, and it's a place where we sit to have meetings with clients, but also sit to talk with the workers, and it's really great being able to share one space together. I think that we inform each other in the sense that we see what the other person is working on, and there are a lot of parallels in design between graphic design and architecture. We generally consult with them anything that has to do with color and proportion, and they consult with us on architectural issues of scale and space. And we always saw the building. We kind of noticed it was this 1920s eclectic building with beautiful kind of ceiling with murals and friezes or frames on the edge of the walls. And somehow the building seemed a lot more put together than where we were. We were working out of a studio space with broken windows and a really, really dodgy street. And the move one street north really changed everything.
I'm a collector of paper. Print matter, yeah, anything that's a print matter. So the studio, you know, is surrounded by different anything from postcards to packaging. I love the fact that you enter the space and it's just like a vivid space. I love the fact that before you even, you know, stepped inside, you see something very, very graphic happening. And I think that there's something very happy about it. these spaces here in Gan HaChashmal, they have the most unique floor tiles and also like a very concentrated area of it.
In terms of the soundtracks, it can start off as a melancholy kind of slow. It does kind of complement your mood in the sense that you can start off with something that's slightly more somber, and then it works its way up to an upbeat tempo and really reflects various feelings or emotions that you go through when you are designing. We constantly play music in the studio. There's studios that are kind of silent working environments, and here it kind of goes with the eclectic mix. We have days where we have cheesy kind of 80s music in Keech, and it's intentional Keech, and then there are days where we kind of want something that's a little bit more kind of classic and serious.
Seu poder vem do sol, minha medida, meu bem, vamos viver a vida, então vem, senão eu vou perder quem sou, vou querer me mudar para uma life on Mars.
David Bowie's Life on Mars, as revisioned by Sue George, from the soundtrack to Wes Anderson's film The Life Aquatic. Still to come in part two, we'll meet the design duo behind the London production of The Paper Architect, fine-tune our ears to the silence of the soundscape at the Hampton Flower Show, and finish our series looking at some of the talented designers emerging from the capital's graduation shows.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Aleph John. Now, the odd paper cut would be enough to deter most from taking up the work of our next guests, who have spent months folding, cutting, and shaping the material into a stage set. Design duo Davey and Kristen Maguire won the prestigious Oxford Samuel Beckett Theatre Trust Award last October, and have spent the past 9 months conceiving of, designing, fabricating, and directing The Paper Architect, which combines paper cutouts, projections, and live stage acting. After going through reams of paper and hours of projections, Davey and Kristen caught up with Monocle's Tess McCann in the theatre space in Leytonstone, where the show debuted last Monday.
We won the award that funded the production, the Oxford Samuel Beckett Theatre Trust Award. We won that in October, so we already started negotiating, you know, the copy and pictures and the title back then, and then we started properly working on it in January. Yeah, so it's been 6 months. We've done two theatre shows before. One is a very, very small one called The Iceberg, which uses similar techniques, so paper cutouts and projections. And then a couple of years ago, we did a bigger theatre production called House Moving Castle, where we also projected onto a big paper set almost. And this now is something in between the two.
Our sort of technique that we're using in this is a mixture between paper cutting and paper cut and projections and silhouettes. And on top of that, we have an actor interacting with silhouettes and paper models.
It's about a lonely old man who lives his life vicariously through the work he makes, through the models he makes. So he creates all sorts of landscapes, houses, and then he imagines them coming to life, which is what the projections are. So the projections in the piece show what's going on inside the character's brain. It's a very tricky medium to get your head around it when you have to make a story for it, because certain things aren't possible, because we don't use language for the tiny figures that are projected. We have to think of a story that works without language, so it's very symbolic. There's a lot of symbols in there that actually tell the story, and the story is very, like I said earlier, it's sort of quite simple, but I think still very powerful in its simplicity. So we're looking at a space with lots of paper models. So on the left-hand side, there is a paper model which is actually inspired by a road where we live. So it's houses, and we'll project characters into the windows of the houses. Wow. Then in the center is a very big sort of forest diorama with lots of trees and a tree house and a little tent and bird cages and deer feeders. So a lot of detail in there. And then in the front, there's a dance pavilion, which is sat on a record player because there's a ballerina figure spinning inside when you put the light on. And then there's little origami birds because Stamp, that's the name of the character, he gets all these eviction notes because he has to leave the space and he just doesn't want to leave. So he folds them all up into origami birds and, you know, chucks them away like you would do with a bill you don't want to pay. The rest of the set, like these models over there, there's a building and a little phone box and other models. They don't get used in the show, but they just show what he usually does. You know, lots of boxes with models inside. And we usually have an idea, we have a vision of something, and then we try to bring that vision into existence. And whatever it requires to make that happen, we'll have a stab at it. We'll go and learn how to cut paper. We'll go and learn how to use certain softwares and whatever. Whatever the vision needs, we'll try to learn. Mm. So I think that's how we got into more of an art field, I guess.
Our first foray into that was a project called The Ice Book. It's a pop-up book that works on in a very similar way that you each page has a projection in it and a pop-up that interact with each other, basically. The idea for that came from the idea that I had to make a big stage show that would open like a pop-up book and have characters come out and real characters' projections and this big, massive pop-up book stage. So we made a small version of that, and we found that actually the medium of paper and projections and the small scale worked really beautifully, and it sort of came alive like that, really, and probably worked better on that small scale than it would have done on a big scale. So yeah, I think that's how it came about, paper and projections. That was our first sort of go at it, really.
It's all yours.
You're listening to Section D with me, Alad John, on Monocle 24. The last thing that anyone wants to hear when settling down in their garden for a moment of peace and quiet is the roar of their neighbour's engine, or the whine of a hedge trimmer. In our busy lives, we often overlook the need for some quiet and for factoring in low noise technology when designing the ideal home or garden. At the forefront of finding solutions for unwanted noise is UK charity the Noise Abatement Society. Its distinctive purple mark of approval, Quiet Mark, is awarded to those companies who have developed silent products that harmonise our living spaces, from hybrid cars to sound barrier fences and even the odd acoustic cloud. Monocle's Alexa Firmanage paid a visit to their first outdoors soundscape experience at the RHS Flower Show and caught up with Quiet Mark's managing director, Poppy Elliott.
So we've got the Epiphany Orchestra, who are playing on silent instruments, you know, a violinist, drum player, flute, keyboard. Yesterday we had a cello as well. And we're doing like a world first for sound portraits, where people can have a personal musical portrait done of them as they sit in front of the band. The band orchestra improvise and basically reflect kind of what they sound like. Not what they look like, but what they sound like. So that's what we're experiencing here right now.
And what would be the use of a silent orchestra? You know, isn't the whole point of music to be heard out loud?
Well, absolutely. But often when lots of musicians want to practice, they're living themselves in like close proximity to their neighbours, and they don't want to be practicing, you know, for hours. It's just a way to still have excellence of sound, but you're not disturbing neighbours. And it's also quite an amazing experience to like just put the headphones on and be kind of in a secret world where you can hear the music and no one else can.
So let's take a listen.
We basically treasure hunted about 35 product categories from all over the world, from everything washing machines to cars, dishwashers, kettles, garden tools, but also some more unusual things like quiet instruments and acoustic clouds, all sorts of solutions to sound insulate your home or workplace and make it a little bit quieter, more peaceful and supportive, yeah.
How does sound affect us? I know that you say that it has a detrimental effect on our health, especially these days where we have so much information coming in.
I think we're starting to realize just how much it does affect us. Sound is just as important as light, and we're always concerned with the visual, but actually the oral has just as much impact on us, and that design in any kind of product or living space also we feel very strongly should be considered as well, so that it supports our health, our productivity, happiness. And when you get the sound right, you have a whole different experience in your day.
Do you find that people are getting more concerned now about the sound within their homes? Is this a trend that you're starting to see?
Very, very much so. Yeah, it's happened quite suddenly over the past year or so. I think product designers are looking to raise the agenda in terms of investment in that area of products. I think maybe because we've got like technology golden age where everything's tech and you get like an orchestra of sounds around you. It's great that the stuff does great stuff for you, but there's also a whole load of noise and sounds and beeps and what have you that you have to also endure. And I think we're all looking to a place now where we have to kind of run away and get a few bit of peace and quiet just to then go back and enter the world again.
And actually, maybe I could explain a little bit about where we are right now, because it sounds very peaceful, but outside there's a lot of things going on. We're in a little hut.
Yeah, we've called it My Quiet Hut, and it's a little shepherd's hut. And we've got a little acoustic clouds. It's been sound insulated. It's like a grown-up Wendy house, basically. Really, really beautifully wood-made, tailor-made, bespoke-made, so that you can have a little place in your back garden or wherever you are. You can just go to sit and, I don't know, meditate, pray, have a moment on your own, just to regroup and download, yeah.
These acoustic clouds, I described them before as carpets in the sky. These are just some of the items that you're featuring now on the show today. Maybe you could describe some of the other things that we've been looking at.
Yeah, we've got represented all different areas of outdoor technology. So you've got the state-of-the-art commercial lawn care, very, very quiet, or the quietest lithium-ion battery garden tools, which are really high performance, but like don't annoy your neighbours so much. We've got the very quiet hybrid cars, so from Lexus, the IS and the CT, which are hybrid, so very powerful, but also have a beautiful sound quality inside the car and outside. We have very powerful industrial fans, so a lot of, especially in this hot weather, amazing cooling down, but you can hardly hear them. And all sorts of other amazing little bits of tech to make our world a little bit more peaceful, and acoustic fencing and barriers to stop neighbour noise, yeah.
Hi there, I'm Andy from Makita, UK. Just like to demonstrate the 25cc petrol two-stroke engine for you. Just like to start that up now for you. Okay, from going one extreme to the other, this is our lithium brush cutter. So basically just demonstrate that for you noise-wise.
There's quite a big difference, no?
Yeah, it's the sound quality. It's a much like softer noise, so you're not going to kind of, you know, annoy your neighbours so much with that one. It's just it's still powerful, but it's just the sound is a bit softer.
Do you think that the issue is that we just have maybe too many machines these days in our everyday lives? And I mean, one measure is to make them more silent, but do you have any sort of ideas about initiatives to maybe bring in less machines?
I think it's a question of machines are very, very useful. But often the investment hasn't been made in the design process for the acoustics of the machines. Now, loads of manufacturers are now really thinking this through. And I think the ultimate is finding a really high-performance machine that does the job, but you have a beautiful sound quality. I mean, in a fantasy land, you know, what about a washing machine that sounds like birds singing? You know, or, you know, anything's possible to make basically sound supportive around us. Sound is beautiful. It's the unwanted noise we want to get rid of, the kind of, like, grating, irritating. Sound is so complex in its dimensions. And if we can maybe understand that more, then, yeah, I think that would sort of help us on a daily basis, yeah.
Because actually one of the other questions I wanted to ask you was, you know, how do you feel about the other extreme? Maybe too much silence is bad in itself as well, instead of too much sound.
Well, I've never had that much silence to know the detrimental effects. I think if we look at, you know, say, you know, the monastic life that some, I don't know, you know, nuns or what have you, or people go away to have a retreat. I think when you're silent, you can hear that still small voice of calm, and you can actually receive ideas, direction in that place of stillness that you just can't hear when you've got so much going on. It's almost like you're just battling to survive sometimes with the sound that comes at you in the everyday journey through, I don't know, an urban environment or where you're living in your home.
And where do you feel that the responsibility lies to make our lives more peaceful and quiet? Do you think it's more of a individual thing? Do you think that companies should be doing it? Do you think maybe even the government should be getting involved?
Well, we are actually supported by DEFRA, the Department of the Environment. So the government are already, you know, cheering this on. I think basically we've all got ears. We're all consumers. We all have this technology. We really don't, there's nobody that hasn't got a phone now or a washing machine or a car or what have you. So I think it's something that we've all got to make a choice when we go and buy a product. As much as the pollution of like smoking is now, you have to do it outside a building or it's in a separate place, that if we all choose to buy quiet, then the world will become more peaceful.
Poppy Elliott, ending that report there by our Alexa Firmanich. We turn now to the third and final instalment in our series on London's Architecture School's summer shows. This week, we'll be visiting the Architectural Association's School of Architecture, or the AA for short. Showcasing the work of over 650 students studying in its units and design programmes, the AA's Projects Review exhibition is well worth a view. World famous and esteemed, the AA has seen the likes of Sir Nicholas Grimshaw, Zaha Hadid, Rem Koolhaas and Richard Rogers pass through its tutelage. As the oldest independent school of architecture in the UK, the AA sets its stall on being an institution that creates culture through experimentation and discussion within its doors. Monocle's Annabel Bly met with the school's director, Brett Steele, to find out more about the AA's ambitions, as well as some of the many students showcasing their talents.
The studio explores these unknown fields. That's the title of our unit. So we explore these landscapes that are forgotten and not often explored, and we find sort of these contradictory realities that already exist, and we speculate on top of that these sort of science fiction scenarios that we propose. So my project is about looking at the cocaine production and demand in America.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of maps in front of me.
Yeah.
What kind of, how would you describe what these kind of projections?
So these projections are looking at sort of a story of this cocaine as an invasive species growing in Louisiana, and then sort of supplying the entire cocaine demand for the USA, and sort of looking at the consequences that will have across the global scale, and as well as looking at the microscopic scale. So it's a story narrated through shifting of these scales.
Hi, I'm Mond. I am in Diploma 6, and I am currently a graduated fifth year. And I studied at the AA for 3 years.
So Mond, we're sitting in front of six large plasma screens,
yeah.
Which is your project.
Yeah, one screen is my project. Yes, all six of them are different projects, all of them having at different times and showreels at different times.
It's
like the control center where you can get an overview of everyone's project sitting at this place. And then I guess this bottom screen is what is my project about. And it's almost about talking about an island on the southeast coast of Mexico called Atitnalta, where it's mining this mineral called otanif. And this documentary trailer is basically revealing that this place has now been taken over by the Los Zeta, and they're using them as illegal mining to sort of mine these to mine this mineral. And these places around the world, well, especially Atitnalta, is generating these settlements that are informal, and they've grown up from the edges of this basin and valley. So you see this, and then also this all exists online. So you can Wikipedia Atitnalta and it'll pop up on Wikipedia. You can check it out on Google Earth and it exists on Google now. And all the images that you see on Panoramio, the videos on YouTube, and also the webcams that pop up on Google Earth is actually real. So it's live online right now.
Okay.
But actually what you see before you's all been a fiction. So all like from the name of the island I've actually constructed myself, to the Wikipedia page, to all these images I fabricated, so that exists online. So it's almost, I've designed a project for it to be viewed online.
Which is where reality is for so many people.
That now it's our modern understanding of place. So that's, I guess, my project in a nutshell.
I'm Brett Steele, and I direct the Architectural Association School of Architecture, which is a full-time school of architecture here in Bedford Square. The AA's got a really, really simple ambition, which is to say we never know how to teach architecture because we don't know what it is right now. But our job in the history of this place is to really change architecture and its future. And the only way to pursue that goal is through the work on it undertaken in portfolios or in relation to design briefs that are set for the year.
Would it be fair to say that there is a certain culture within the AA that you try to foster as a school?
Yeah, it's absolutely a culture of experimentation, or the idea of architectural experimentation, that the most interesting challenge an old grand discipline like architecture ever faces, the most interesting challenges it faces, is how to continue to reinvent itself, how to really question ideas about how people should live in cities, how we should build things that look like or act like spaces or structures or buildings, and to really do that work with an awareness of what the world is like today, because it's a problem today, and the things that happened in the past won't usually give us a really viable model for how to do that.
And you've got a great base here in Bedford Square in central London. Perhaps you could tell me about some of the lectures and the ways that you engage the greater design community in London.
Yeah, I think you could say that the principal form of engagement for the Architectural Association is that we run a public program that's directed not to our full-time students and staff here in the school, although plenty of them attend, but actually the larger community of like-minded souls like us that want to engage questions of design, architecture, the city, and culture in a broad public setting. The interesting feature of the Architectural Association is that it was set up to do that long before it found a way to create a school of architecture. One of the things we're really exploring in the school in different forms is how an architectural project can be part of a larger cultural agenda or idea, and the role architecture might play in larger cultural projects today. And I think that's something that an intelligent mind can engage at literally any stage of his or her career.
So what is the relationship between the school, the students and staff within the school, and an architecture practice? Because as well as, you know, forming architectural culture and this experimental culture that you've talked about, how does it relate to things as they are outside?
Well, it's a school that's probably, the AA school is known for creating those personalities that then go on and become the leading professional figures of their generation, and that's still the case today. I think it's the legacy of that, the various architectural and designer celebrities and leading lights and figures that have come through this place, are the kind of things that will attract a certain sort of audience of future students that want to come here because of the things that happened by some of our famous people in the past. But the key to a school like this is, and the way to overcome the weight of that kind of legacy, is to actually focus the attention entirely on the work that's being done now in the school. The school, like many schools around the world, tends to move on very quickly. It's a sort of continual arms race of invention and innovation and discovery. And the principal consequence of that, what I've learned over the years, is the need to actually push that stuff more than anything, the stuff that was finished last week. That's why you can walk around a show here and see the things that were, you know, the ink is just drying on some of this work. Some of the 3D models are just hardening as you see them in the show.
So obviously the AA is unique in the fact that it is architecture focused. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the school misses out on anything through not having a broader church?
Yeah, I do. And I've often said that in the next century, in our name, the Architectural Association, the word that's going to matter more is association. Actually, the ability for us, with a deep belief and interest in architecture, to find a way to take that interest into other arenas will actually be a huge and important project, i.e. to find a way to enter into genuinely public arenas of discussion about things, into political arenas, into arenas of planning. You know, those three P's on their own are like worlds outside of architecture strictly. But of course, they're all worlds that are today quite interested in architects and architecture, for the obvious reasons of the role that architecture plays in shaping the world around us.
Thank you very much indeed, Annabelle. And I'm afraid that's all we have time for in this week's edition of Section D. Thank you to Holly Fisher for her deft and diligent editing. You can contact me at awj@monocle.com if you want to feature on the programme, or maybe just bend my ear about an idea you've had. I'm Alla John, and playing you out, here's a favourite from my recent trip to the south of France. This is Australian artist Hiatus Coyote, featuring the one and only Q-Tip with Nakamura. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Hannah, my darling, I will follow you into white city folks who jokes that we something like razorbacks. Talk about us quietly, a rich social quarters, about a fertile land and a rolling lush waters. And they really should embrace us, cause they know we got the science. But the bottom line is, they don't want the brown alliance. They rather get our secrets and they don't believe mistreat us. Take our color and our culture from the foul way they breed us. They are such a fucking leaders with no intention to free us. And if you believe in love, then imagine what the key is. The sentiment for me is simply love.